Yeah. So my intention of about today was it should have a real feeling of celebration. That's all the flags. Because I'm sure all of us feel enormous gratitude for the Dharma. And, you know, gratitude does not have to be all serious and sombre. In fact, I think it inevitably contains a lot of joy, so that, we should be celebrating joyfully. Last week, someone who occasionally comes here, actually, was asking me what it was, because I was asking if she was coming, and she said, what is it? What are these festivals? And I said, oh, well, there are various festivals throughout the year, you know, which celebrate various things, like Buddha's enlightenment, or, you know, this one, his first teaching. So she went, oh, you mean any excuse to have a party? And I said, well, yes, actually, that's true. Because in a way it is that, these festivals, what these festivals are. But it isn't just any excuse to have a party, it's a really, really good reason to have a party. So that's the spirit of today. On the other hand, what we're grateful about and celebrating is really serious, important stuff. Because what we're grateful for is basically being told the truth. Dharma, just in case someone doesn't know, it just simply means the truth. And that's what the Buddha did. He just told the truth about everything. And pulled no punches. So I'm going to start with a poem and a song, because there's another wheel other than the one we're celebrating today, which is, oh, it's not there. Where is it? Over there. Somewhere. Is it somewhere? Oh, sorry. I meant to put it. which is the Wheel of Life. The it's all right, you don't really need to see it. I just thought it was there. It's the Wheel of Life. It's this endless cycle of samsara that we are whirling around on over and over again. So this is a poem by Wendy Cope. I think it's such a funny and perfect description, really, of samsara. Of sort of the same things over again. Slightly different, but more or less the same. And that's what we do, you know, we try and change things, but we are kind of rearranging the furniture a bit, when what we really need to do is completely move out and rebuild our house. Anyway, you have to listen quite carefully to the words, but you'll get the idea. It's called Some More Light Verse. You have to try, you see a shrink. You learn a lot, you read, you think. You struggle to improve your looks. You meet some men. You write some books. You eat good food. You give up junk. You do not smoke. You don't get drunk. You take up yoga, walk and swim. And nothing works, the outlook's grim. You don't know what to do, you cry. You're running out of things to try. You blow your nose, you see the shrink. You walk, you give up food and drink. You fall in love, you make a plan. You struggle to improve your man. And nothing works, the outlook's grim. You go to yoga, cry and swim. You eat and drink, you give up looks. You struggle to improve your books. You cannot see the point, you sigh. You do not smoke. You have to try. So, samsara for you. And it's not going to stop if we just use those methods. So this is a song. It's rather a sombering song, but a very beautiful, nevertheless, song by Amy Mann called Wise Up.
What you thought when you first began it, you got what you want, that you can hardly stand it though, but now
to me, but you could...
Yeah, it's a bit distorted, because then if you put those things up loud, they don't really sound that good.
Anyway, distracted. Okay. So, when I was a child, since I was a child, actually, I have always been, and was, since I can remember, really passionate about the truth. I don't really know why, but I remember it's just always been a thing with me. And always wanting to know how things worked and what was really going on. But kind of being passionate about the truth has always been a big deal with me. And one of the things I dislike most is inauthenticity. I used to drive my parents completely mad by refusing to be a particular way or say a particular thing just to be polite. Because I thought that was not authentic, and I just would not do it. And I'm sure I was a complete pain in the ass. And I used to get in a complete fury with my mother, because her default attitude was polite. And she would be terribly nice to people that I knew she really disliked. And she would say things were lovely, even when I knew she hated them. And I really, that really used to annoy me. And I especially hated her doing things like telling me that I looked lovely when I could see quite clearly that I was about 3 stone overweight and covered in spots. And in case you're thinking I had a distorted body image, no, because I have a photograph of me. And I looked ghastly. I was overweight and covered in spots. Now, and I knew that, you know. And there she is going, you look lovely, dear. Well, it just didn't help. I mean, I might tell someone who looked like that that they are lovely, but, you know, I'd go, yeah, but actually, you do need to lose some weight. You know, you'd look great if you could just lose a bit more weight, and let's see what we can do about those spots. And meanwhile, I think we can find a better outfit than that one. I'd be kind of, you know, encouraging, but I wouldn't go, yes, you look lovely. Yeah, so I suppose, does my bum look big in this? Is a question that I want answered completely truthfully. Apparently, men think women just want to hear no in answer to that question, but I don't think that's right. Frankly, my bum does look pretty big in anything, and I don't give a toss now, but I still want to be aware of how it looks. And I think it's much kinder for people who do mind what they look like to tell the truth and say, actually, it doesn't look great in that, might look better in this, whatever. My dad was not as bad as my mum. He he had a kind of dry, droll sense of humour. And when he did make not entirely honest statements out of politeness, they were sort of quite funny. And I remember I once told him, I can't remember if we were at an exhibition or if I told him later about what I'd written in the comments book of an exhibition, which was ghastly. And I had written some coruscating thing about how ghastly it was. And he said, no, you don't need to do that. All you need to say is interesting, because that covers the whole spectrum. Although, see, I don't even like that really, because it's a bit too close to that thing like, it's different.
Yeah.
That people say when they're completely baffled by something or they don't actually like it. People say it to me quite a lot. About how I look, my flat, what I'm saying. Different. I think, yeah, I know what that means. So I was a real pain about it. And of course I did eventually learn that you do need to temper the truth. In order not to hurt or annoy people and to get by in society. But I still prefer honesty over niceness. And although nowadays I know the importance of saying things in the right way at the right time, otherwise they're not effective and they're not kind as they could be, I do still prefer the truth over anything else. Now, apparently a study in 2009... found out that on average men lied 6 times a day and women lied 3 times a day. But what I find really interesting is that the most frequently told lie for both genders was, nothing's wrong, I'm fine.
Yeah.
And another survey this year, in fact, with no gender differentiation, said that the average person lies 4 times a day. I was trying to work out if that's kind of better or worse. It's about the same, I think. And now the most common lie is, nothing's wrong, I'm fine. And, you know, shocking as that is, and I did feel a bit shocked when I saw that. But, of course, it's not really surprising, because it's what most people want to hear, and it's what most people want to believe. They'd rather believe the lie than have to deal with the truth. So, my childhood again, because, of course, that was my mother's default position, that lie, and it was how she wanted everyone to be. So, when I was little, I was not allowed to be either sad or cross or upset in any way, because that was labelled being in a bad mood. So if I was in a bad mood, I was put into a nice hot bath to make me feel better. I think mainly because that's what my mum did when she was in any way distressed. She would go and have a nice hot bath, which helped her suppress how she was really feeling. So the reality of how I was feeling was denied pretty consistently when I was little, which I don't think is entirely unconnected to having a lot of trouble with depression later in life, actually. But of course sometimes I tell lies. I mean, we all do, in case you're thinking I don't. Yes, you do, we all do. But I don't think I tell anywhere near three a day, I don't think. I've been thinking about it the last few days since I wrote this, and I certainly haven't, at least not to anyone else. And I never say, nothing's wrong, I'm fine, if that's not how I'm feeling. And of course, I find being told unpleasant truths, especially about myself, difficult, you know. And certainly in this tradition, you get quite a lot of feedback, and certainly on the road to ordination, you get quite a lot of home truths told to you, which you need to hear, because, you know, it's useful. And I really would rather hear the truth than a load of flannel. I just don't think anything else is ultimately helpful. I think telling the truth is the kindest thing you can do in the end. And I think telling us the truth was an example of the Buddha's ultimate kindness. So although it's not often easy, and it might not be what you want to hear, somehow it's just a relief to hear the truth, because somewhere in your being you know it, you recognise it. I'll be careful not to go on a rant here, but I'm very unkeen on all this kind of PC language. I mean, apart from obvious racist or sexist stuff that's is healthily banished, but PC language just drives me crazy, and I can't bear this modern trend of making everything seem less troubling than it is, like using the word issues instead of problems, you know, so if you don't say the word problem, there isn't any. And positive spin is another thing I think is very iffy. That putting on of rose-tinted spectacles that seems to be rather endemic in our society these days. And a friend of mine told me this, I was appalled, and actually she was appalled about this. Her son, at her son's school, the national average for GCE scores last year was that 50% of students got at least 5 GCSEs with an A to C grade. Right? But at her son's school, they had been at that level for the last couple of years, but last year it really got worse. It really dropped, and it was pretty bad. So a lot less than 50% of the students got 5 GCSEs with anywhere near those grades. But she had a letter from the headmaster, I mean, as did all parents, saying that they could be proud that 80% of the students got at least 1 GCSE. Well, frankly, you know, she was going, I don't think that's anything to be proud of, and nor do I. And it's all that kind of, I think it's just a problem here. And it's to do with a particular kind of high self-esteem that seems to be promoted in our culture these days. Nothing wrong with, you know, good self-esteem, but it's this particular kind of high self-esteem that happens these days, and which is inevitably accompanied by low awareness. And I think that teachers are probably more or just as culpable as parents. So this is a poem by Billy Collins, the history teacher. Trying to protect his students' innocence, he told them the Ice Age was really just the Chilly Age, a period of a million years when everyone had to wear sweaters. And the Stone Age became the Gravel Age, named after the long driveways of the time. The Spanish Inquisition was nothing more than an outbreak of questions such as, how far is it from here to Madrid? Or, what do you call the matador's hat? The War of the Roses took place in a garden. And the Enola Gay dropped one tiny atom on Japan. The children would leave his classroom for the playground to torment the weak and the smart, mussing up their hair and breaking their glasses. While he gathered up his notes and walked home past flower beds and white picket fences, wondering if they would believe that soldiers in the Boer War told long, rambling stories designed to make the enemy nod off. Yeah. And as Larkin famously said in another poem, which I'm not going to read, they fuck you up, your mum and dad. They may not mean to, but they do. And I think one of the ways in which my parents certainly didn't help was telling me, or at least really quite strongly giving me the idea that everything would be all right, that life would be easy, you know, as long as I worked hard enough to get my O&O levels, and that once I was grown up, things would be all right. Well, they weren't. And once I realised that, I really felt quite pissed off with them for not telling me the truth, because they could have told me in a perfectly kind and helpful way, you know, and at least I'd have been prepared then. And I really am quite puzzled about why people don't tell their children a bit more, a bit more of the truth, because it is much kinder, I think, and you can do it in a really helpful way. So I don't really understand it. Anyway, they didn't tell me, so I wasn't prepared, and things were okay for a while, and then they weren't. And I didn't know how to deal with it. So first of all, I got very depressed. Then I spent a number of years using drugs and quite a lot of drink. And as any man says, you're sure there's a cure, and you have finally found it. You think one drink will shrink you till you're underground and living down, but it's not going to stop. And of course it didn't stop. All the coke and all the drinks didn't make it stop, except briefly. In fact, they made it a lot worse and got me into a lot of trouble. And I'm still suffering the consequences of the drugs and the things I did when I was addicted. And then, finally, I had a breakdown. And through that, at last, came across the Dharma. And it was just such a really, really big relief to finally hear someone telling the truth. To hear that, yes, life is often difficult and painful. And then to be able to understand that there's nothing wrong with me or any of us individually that we find life difficult or painful. It's just how humans are. It's just how things are. And no, everything is not going to be okay. But we can learn to be okay with how things are, which is good news. But we have to accept the truth of how things are and how we are before we can begin to change. Because you can't move or change from anywhere except a basis of truth, because it's the only solid ground there is, so you can't push off or move off from anything else but solid ground. So this is what the Buddha taught in that first turning of the wheel. In fact, he taught the Four Noble Truths, which is basically just telling it like it is and telling us what we can do about it. All of which is a huge relief and a huge thing to be grateful for. And I was thinking about the Buddha's parents, and that they were actually a lot worse than mine in not telling the truth. They actively hid the truth from him in a very major way. But in fact, they were just doing that same thing, telling the same old, nothing's wrong, it's fine, lie. Which he knew, somewhere inside, he knew it wasn't right. And in a way, him leaving the palace, going out and finding the foresight, seeing suffering for himself, and then going on to leave home, going forth completely, in a way, that's kind of just doing what any kid does when they rebel against their parents. They go out and find their truth in some way and leave home. It's just that in his case, he did it in a rather enormous way and did a lot more than that, because he found out the absolute truth for the whole of humanity. And I was also thinking that his parents' attempt to keep him from seeing suffering. In other words, a complete turning away from suffering. And his subsequent going out, seeing it and investigating it himself, is a model in microcosm of his whole approach to how to deal with the reality of being human, which is to turn towards suffering, examine it so you can understand it and its causes fully, and then take the steps necessary to be free from it. Of course, we can't ever be free from the existence of Buddha because it's simply part of life, but as Christopher Reeve and probably some other people have said this, but I just liked it when he said it. The first person I'd heard say this. He said, suffering is inevitable, but misery is a choice. Because we can be free of what we add to it. In other words, our reactions to it. That's what we can choose to be free from. And there's a nice Zen story where a master says, when it's hot, the Buddha just sweats. When it's cold, the Buddha just shivers. And the student says, well, how is that wisdom? You know, I sweat and I shiver. And the master says, you miss the word just. Because we add so much. So my kind of, my daily mantra is the only way to deal with dukkha is to be interested in it. And funny enough, I think I learnt that originally from my dad, although he'd never heard of dukkha, and only in the area of physical suffering. But I did learn that approach from him, I think. But it was years before I realised that it applies to all sorts of dukkha, and before I stopped trying to avoid it in various ways, which, as we know, doesn't work for long or very well. And well, we get an awful lot of lies told to us, or at least untruths, or what is that phrase? Being conservative with the truth, or whatever. Or at least economical, that's it, yeah. Being economical with the truth, yeah. We get a lot of that. Not just from our parents, but our culture, our politicians, newspapers, work colleagues, all sorts of people, lovers, you know, and of course ourselves, our own ego processes. And all of the untruths or economical withtruths that we take on board, they just hugely increase the tension between our desires and reality. And that makes it harder to hear the truth. Because the thing about truth is mostly we don't really want to hear it, or at least our ego processes don't want us to hear it, or don't want to hear it. And so I think it's just kind of ironic, really, that the cause of suffering, craving, our desires, is precisely why we find it so hard to find the way out of suffering. And the views we construct from our desires are what make it so hard to hear the truth. It's hard to hear the truth because we don't want things to be as they are. We want things to be different, which is what craving is all about. And that is why the Buddha hesitated before he decided he could teach. Because he had realised, I mean, with a capital R, he had realised exactly how humans are and how they work, and he knew the strength of that cause of suffering and how difficult it would make for humans to hear the truth. So he initially just really didn't think it was possible. Because he knew how hard it was, that's why. There's quite a lot of mentions in the scriptures about how hard it is to hear Dharma. Not only because it's hard to come across, which is another reason, it is very hard to come across, but also that it's just hard for us to hear it. Like this bit in the White Lotus Sutra, which refers to both aspects of it being hard to hear. All Buddhas come into the world, but rarely, and are hard to meet. And when they appear in the world, it is hard for them to speak the Dharma. Throughout countless ages too, it is difficult to hear this Dharma. And those who can hear this Dharma, such people too are rare. And the Buddha actually says himself quite often in the first teaching, which we will hear, or at least we will listen to later, he says quite a few times, such was the insight, the knowledge, the understanding, the vision, the light that arose in me about things not heard before. Now, I'm not entirely sure about this, but I don't think he's talking about other people not having heard it before. Or he may be talking about other people as well, but I think he means he's never really heard it before, he's saying that, because he had never really stilled and clarified and calmed his mind and his desires enough before for delusions to fall away and for him to see and hear the truth clearly himself. Because, of course, hearing doesn't just mean hearing with your lug holes, or even understanding the words intellectually. There's much more to it than that, although that's what you need to do to start off with, very definitely. It's also very much about absorbing and knowing the truth in your depths, and through practice, through reflection. So, actually, you really do have to work with the heart-mind to truly hear, and that takes effort. You know, that's our practice, which is another aspect of the reason it's hard to hear, because it takes a bit of effort. But luckily, he did decide that there might be some people with but little dust in their eyes who would be able to hear it, so he did start to teach. And he just told things how they are, told the truth. And some people really heard. And people have gone on hearing ever since. Rolling stones gather no moss, but the rolling wheel of Dharma just goes on gathering more and more teachers. More and more people who hear the Dharma and then pass it on. And that means all sorts of people on all sorts of levels are part of this turning wheel. So teachers of the past, teachers of the present, of all traditions. For us in the Tri Ratna, of course, mainly Bante. And then others who lead retreats, who write books, who teach at centres, who give talks, and so on, including every single one of you, all of us here. Just by having heard some Dharma that's affected you and communicating it to someone else, or by encouraging someone you know to come along to the centre, do a course, you are turning that wheel. So we're all part of this turning wheel. Of course, today we're celebrating the first turning of the wheel, but I do think we should also bear in mind we're also celebrating all of us who keep the wheel turning, because we're all part of the Dharma Chakra, and that's to be rejoiced in and celebrated. So I think we'll all give ourselves three big sadhus.
Sadhu! Sadhu!
I don't usually do this at the end of talks, do it at the end of retreats and things, but it just seemed, because of what I was saying, just seemed kind of appropriate. So I would like to end by thanking my teachers. I just get weepy now. I'll just be a moment. Yeah, so firstly Bante Sangharakshita, who is a fantastic clarifier and explainer of the Dharma, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, I don't think I would have understood it from anyone else, actually. Certainly not as quickly. When I say understand, I don't, of course, mean you know. yes, and without whom this wouldn't be here, we wouldn't be here today. And I might not be here at all. And then I'd like to thank Paramananda, who is, for many years, has been a really good and close friend of mine, and co-teacher. But originally, he was the person I first encountered when I came along. He was the one who did my very first taster drop-in session. Boy, was that lucky. Because at that time, I was so bound by my views and likes and dislikes that if it had been any other of the order members, who it could well have been, you know, who I later got to know and like, but at that point in time, if it'd been anyone else, I wouldn't have been back. So I was really, really lucky. Subsequently, he was my first meditation teacher. I got the best. So I'm really grateful to him. In case you're wondering, he's not here. I'd be saying if he was here, and I do occasionally tell him how grateful I am. He doesn't take much notice, but I do tell him. And then I'd like to thank Ratnadharani, who is my private preceptor, who is another wonderful, really excellent Dharma teacher. I'm particularly grateful to her for breaking my view that I was no good at study. Mm-hmm. And she really encouraged me to teach in my own ways. And Reggie Ray, who's an American teacher from the Tibetan tradition, who was very affirming about what I do, working with the body, and has been really helpful in conceptualising things for me, because I'm not very good at that. I can figure out things, and I know I'm doing them, I know it's important, but I'm not very good at conceptualising them, so I'm grateful to him for that. And he's just a very good teacher, and it's nice, it's just great to be around a good teacher. And my friends, Sadanandi and Srivati, of course, many friends I want to say thanks to, but Sadanandi and Srivati, they are my favourite co-leaders. And we learn a lot from each other, but I know I've learnt more from them than they've learnt from me. So I'm very grateful to all of my teachers. And we're going to completely finish now with a great song, which you probably all know, which I think I was being very much about disengaging from that other wheel. It has this sense of, I think of it as if you were looking in the back of a clock or a watch, not a digital one, an old one with all those cogs and things in, and looking at how it worked, got that kind of feel for me. And it just has a really nice sense of movement, and it's very joyful. So it's a good way to finish. It's John Lennon.
Lost in confusion. solution.